Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's another Rebooting the News. Jay, you there?
I'm here. It's Rebooting the News number 33.
Number 33. My God, how time flies.
Where are you calling from?
I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, of all places, where it's unseasonably warm. I can't believe how warm it is. I brought this heavy jacket with me, and I don't need it.
Like, what brings you to Cambridge? I know it's one of your old haunts, but why
it is
that?
Just friends. Just I took a train trip from San Francisco to Denver, something I've always wanted to do, and got off the train and said, okay, where am I going to now? And I said, I feel like going to Boston. So I bought a plane ticket went to Boston. I just have this sort of, it's like an itch that I think you do a lot of things when you're, dad does what my dad did. It's like you start doing things unpredictably, like find you have a free bit of time and just go on a train trip. So there you have
Very
it.
Very cool. Now, haven't you been doing a lot of programming recently?
Yeah, I needed a break from that too. I have absolutely been determined to solve problems that I've sort of been leaving unsolved for quite a long period of time.
Well, let us in on it. What are some of the
things? Want me to talk about it a little bit? Yeah, I've been writing about it for a long, long time. The problem is we scatter these writing, we write all over the place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it has its advantages, but it has one major disadvantage in that there's no one place you can go, and there's no one archive, and we're also trusting all these companies, and if you read the user agreements that we have with those companies, there's really not much reason to trust them. They're kind of disclaiming any responsibility. They don't even necessarily have to give us copies of our own stuff. So, I've always been aware of that and have sort of gotten more lax about it over time and just said, oh, what the hell, you need to experience this stuff. So I've done a lot of writing on FriendFeed and certainly on Twitter and so forth, and realizing all the time that this is not a very good thing to do. So I decided that I wanted to try to find a way to do all my link blogging, which is what I think of as what I do on Twitter is mostly that. I see something somewhere and I say, okay, an informed person would want to be aware of this. the usual thing that doesn't mean I agree or I disagree or whatever, other than just I think this should be in front of people. And I call that link blogging, as do many other people. And then there's a longer form of writing. But recently I've been starting all these other blogs, like, well, we've got a new blog for Rebooting the News called rebootnews.com.
Right.
I started one for my love of the droid, and it's called droidy.com. And I have unberkeley.com, which I started after inberkeley.com sort of exploded or imploded, or however you want to put it.
And I have my Tumblr.
You have what?
I have a Tumblr. Oh, just as
you have a Tumblr,
example.
Right, exactly. You're doing the same. And, of course, you're writing on Twitter, and you've done
right. Some
writing on FriendFeed.
Right.
Yeah. So the question is, can we come up with a unified sort of writing space that gives us all the advantages of spraying things all over the place, yet at the same time do the benefits of having one sort of copy of everything that's important? And that's what I've been doing. And the trip actually was more productive than I think I made it sound, was that I needed a deadline, something that I could sort of like aim for with these tools that, once I had the tools working, then I would like take the trip and see if the tools actually worked. And it kind of worked.
All right.
Not fully, not in every regard. I have a long list of things I need to look at. So, I'm going to deduct this trip as a business expense, but so that's kind of I'm a writing tools guy. When you come right down to it, if you look at my history as a developer, sort of everything seems to revolve around, writing and publishing. And I was going to say that
one unifying theme in everything that you've developed is certainly writing and publishing tools. But I was going to say that also, everything that you've done is kind of a declaration of independence.
Yeah, well, I suppose. I think that being dependent is not a good idea. I think that
right.
the, you know,
so
I mean,
independence as a publisher and writer and blogger and linker is what all these things permit, right?
Yes, as much as you can possibly have. You know, the problem is you can't be 100% completely independent, right?
Right.
You know, you're dependent on something, you know, to, you know, a lot of things, actually. But more independence, the better, right?
Right.
Yeah. So.
And I certainly agree with that philosophy.
Yeah, that's why we get along, I think. Fundamentally, we have that same agreement. I think we got a chance in last week's podcast, you know, I don't know how much you want to talk about that, but I think we ought to talk about it a little bit.
All right.
In terms of what we got from it. And I'm just going to speak for myself. You can say what you want to say about what you think, okay, because I don't want to characterize it. But I felt coming off of it that it was not a great podcast. Maybe that's even an understatement. but over time, I came to think differently, that it's only not a success if all we ever hope to do is talk to people who agree with us, right?
Mm-hmm.
You and I have a lot that we do agree on, and that's why we get along, right? And I get along fine with Jennifer Preston. I really like her, you know, admire her, but she very much is of the New York Times. I mean, sometimes it's hard to face that when you realize there is a human voice to it, you know, because their point of view is so dramatically different from ours. Would you agree with that? That it's dramatically different?
Well, yeah, the point of view of a big institution, especially one with the accumulated reputation that the New York Times has, is on several points dramatically different than the way we think and operate.
Mm-hmm. But you're within a huge institution yourself, right? New York University is not a small thing, right?
Yes, we are, except that there's a different relationship between the individual producer of knowledge at New York University and New York University, the brand, than there is between the individual editorial worker at the New York Times and New York Times, the brand. There are some relationships or similarity there, but it's very different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for example, tenured professors outlast the people who lead the institution. I've been here through four different presidents, you know?
You are tenured, is that right, Jay?
Yeah, I'm a tenured professor at NYU.
Right.
So
okay, I didn't know if you had tenure or not. That's why
I got tenure back in 1992. So I've seen four different NYU presidents come and go. You see what I mean?
Yeah, sure. I understand that. And a reporter or an editor at the New York Times has no such guarantees. They
no
don't
such
have
guarantees.
There's no
right.
such thing as tenure in there.
Right. Yeah, so that changes the relationship a lot. And we're supposed to be good citizens and members of NYU, but we're also supposed to be active members of trans-institutional knowledge communities, otherwise known as disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And we belong as much to those disciplines as we do to the institution. And that, too, is a little bit different than the situation at the New York Times. And also the kind of domination that the New York Times has had at the apex of the professional hierarchy in journalism is a little different than what you would find at an NYU or Cornell or a Penn or a Madison, Wisconsin. With our comparable institutions. So those things are very different. However, one of the things that is really going on these days at large news organizations is that attention between the individual voice of writers and the institutional brand is kind of rising to the top and more apparent in the everyday life of these places. So that's just an interesting development.
Yeah, yeah. And people, what I hear from, what I take away from that is people are being more independent, more outspoken, maybe even you're hearing the anger, you know. I read a piece by some an editorial person at Seattle Post Intelligence, or basically about the transition that they did to the web as a sort of after the fact. They're very unhappy with the way it worked, or it did not work. And you don't find universities generally. I mean, I think making the transition much better than the newspapers are in the journals and schools. I had breakfast this morning with Nick O'Malley, I can never pronounce his name right. Nico is, I don't know exactly what his title is, but he's teaching here at the Kennedy School.
Mm-hmm.
Their class in, it's not journalism, although his office is insurance dean, he's teaching just their students there about the Internet. I mean, that's the, he teaches, I think, the only course they have on the Internet there. And I told me what the curriculum was, and it sounded great. I mean, I looked at the last test they took, and, you know, all the right stuff. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody who's been through that, I think, one class will have, you know, one semester worth of good background, but that's not nearly what you're doing, right? I mean, you're trying to give somebody a degree in the, you know, in the Internet, basically, as it intersects journalism. And he was describing
right.
how he's trying to get the kind of, he didn't know about what you were doing, by the way, and so I, of course, told him the best I could. Harvard doesn't seem to be jumping at anything remotely like what you're doing, and there's an awful lot of resistance here. It sounds very much like the resistance you see in the news organizations, you know. I was trying to explain this to somebody on the train, you know, when you take a train, a two-day train ride, you know, you get to know the people that are on the train with you. And,
mm-hmm.
I was trying to explain, you know, what is the disconnect here? Why is there so much difficulty? And I gave them an analogy. It's sort of like in skiing. I don't know if you're a skier, but I've been skiing.
I am, actually.
Are you? Okay, good.
Yeah.
And so it's like if you had ski instructors before there were any recreational skiers, and they had the mountains all to themselves, and one day you said to them, look, next year there are going to be a lot of amateurs here, and they're going to be wanting to ski up and down the mountain, and your job's now changed. You're going to be teaching them how to do this and guiding them through the, you know, when there's a snowstorm, you're going to be helping them out. And you're going to still have a job, but your job isn't going to be just to be admired for being a wonderful skier.
Mm.
Your job now is going to be more functional. You're going to have to take care of all these other people. We'll still pay you, but, you know, it's going to be more prosaic, and there's a lot of resistance. That's more or less the best analogy that I've come up with so far to explain what I see happening here, is that there isn't a lack of need for professionals here. It's just what we need them to do is different. And and that was the discussion I would love to have with somebody from the New York Times on a pragmatic level of how will we do this. You know, what are the next steps? What do you need from Jay, you know? What kind of students would you like Jay to be graduating so that these people will be prepared for this future that we are now envisioning, you know, if you agree that this is where we're going, which is what I think we are doing. But I don't know who to have that conversation with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started to have that conversation with Jennifer Preston, and I've had it with other news media people, and I think it's starting to open up, and part of the reason for that is actually a very profound thing, which is prior to the web, prior to about 2006 or 2007, it's hard to imagine, but the people who ran these big news organizations actually believed, although they never would have said this to themselves this way, that they knew everything there was to know about journalism. And the proof was where they were in the hierarchy, where they had gotten to as journalists. And they didn't see missing knowledge about their work as a problem at all. There was no missing knowledge. There was new stories to conquer and, you know, new sections to birth, and they would add to what they were doing in that way. But the whole idea that there was something that they didn't know that was vital to their institution, it just did not exist. And that has been blown away. That's a big change.
It's Interesting. You know, that goes to something that I read a week ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago. I don't remember exactly when. It was a piece that I read called "Let the World Change You," and it was based on having heard so many times from people in the tech industry how their goal was to change the world, right? And you hear the Twitter guys say this all the time. You know, it's like, well, our goal is to change the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked the question, well, you know, and of course that isn't really the goal of these people that you're describing, right? Their goal
No,
is
they wouldn't say they're out to change the world. They'd say they're...
No, their goal is to observe how the world changes, right? In other words, they might add a new section to the newspaper in response to a change in the world, right?
Right.
But their world is not going to change, right? Mm-hmm. Well, in the tech industry, it's wrong, but it's wrong in the 180-degree opposite way, is that the mission is to change the world. But in fact, I don't think they actually very often do change the world. And God help us if they do, because the vision of the world or the changes that the world needs by a 25 to 35-year-old person is really not going to be very much like what the world really needs. You know?
So what does "let the world change you" mean?
It means that's what's going to happen anyway, so you might as well let it just happen.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it really does happen. I mean, at 54 years old, I've been through, you know, I have actually been through a lot of changes. And, you know, and now is, of course, the time of a big change in my life. And I see something happening in my family that I just can't believe. It, the relationships that seem so set in stone, that they're just always going to be this way, are now changing. You know, and so, you know, that can either make you feel very unsteady, you know, and of course it does actually make you feel unsteady. But what choice do you have but to change when the world is changing you, right? There's nothing you can do but to change with it. So, in fact, that is what life does to you. Life does change you. You're not the same today as you were 20 years ago, Jay. I mean, I didn't know you 20 years ago, but I can make that statement with a great deal of certainty. Your children are younger than 20 years old. So 20 years ago, I don't think you had any children, right?
Right.
Let's see, 20 years ago, you didn't have tenure 20 years ago,
right?
Yeah, you got less than 20. So look at all the things that have changed you. And you know, for the people who run Twitter, I think it's more likely that the world will change them than they will actually change the world. And I don't think they had a vision that went beyond the next few weeks when they started Twitter. They had an intuition, and they have very good intuition. I'm getting, you know, not going to take anything away from that. I mean, they saw something, and they had the good sense to follow it, and the courage to follow it, and the courage to chuck a lot of other things over the, you know, side of the boat when they saw this thing was really working. You know,
and their idea of simplicity is related to a democratic idea they also have, which is one class of users.
Well, but then they blew that.
Well, yeah, well, we've talked about that, but still.
We've talked about it many, many times, but there's another insight I had into this, actually, that it might have been a very clever strategy on their part to do that, to create some users with millions of followers would give the media something to talk about that they wouldn't have had to talk about otherwise.
Yeah. Right.
You know, yeah, and so, you know, maybe there's another side to it that, you know, we've never had them on here, and not only that, I doubt if they would have said that.
Well, speaking of letting the world change you, I was at a conference this week at Yale.
Yeah, how was that?
It was on the future of journalism, but focused very much on some of the business questions that continue to perplex people in the field. And in my own contribution on the first day, I decided to express my irritation at the title they had chosen for this conference, which was Journalism and the New Media Ecology, Who Will Pay the Messenger? And the second part of that title really...
I see why you wouldn't like it.
irritated
say
me.
Say it again. Say it slowly.
Okay, Journalism and the New Media Ecology, and I was fine with that, Who Will Pay the Messenger? And this really...
It reflects
the
point of view, doesn't it?
Yeah, it expresses a point of view as a question, right? So that's the first thing that I didn't like about it. And the whole idea of journalism as messenger, you might like that, but I don't particularly care for that
No, I don't like it at all.
That
I don't
doesn't
think
seem to me a very good description, although it echoes with this whine or complaint that people in the press often have, namely, don't shoot the messenger, right? So that's what that's pointing to.
Uh-huh.
But then the whole idea that this problem of sustainability comes down to who will pay us to continue to do what we do seems
right.
to me to be a retrograde way of going about it. And I gave my remarks saying, well, here's what's wrong with this question. Should have been, who will subsidize the news producers, because it's almost always been subsidized by one thing or another. And after the conference at my Tumblr blog, which is jrosen.tumblr.com, I wrote up my list of all the different types of subsidy that have been seen in editorial production. And I have 18 different kinds now that I've listed that can and have been used to subsidize the news. And there's a good reason why we should put the accent on subsidy, because when news is subsidized, it's more likely to be free. And when it's free, it's available to everybody. And when it's available to everybody, it's what it should be, which is an inherently democratic public good. And I'm not against people charging for their news products. And if you can do it, that's fine. And you should make as much money as you can. But I am against journalists who don't see the democratic importance of freely circulating news. So anyway, subsidy is a really important question, because if we can figure out how to subsidize high quality news and information, that's all to the good. But what I wanted to say about this, to get back to your changing the world or letting the world change you theme, is that a strikingly different thing about this conference compared to many others that I've been to with a similar focus was that it was obvious from the first word that everybody there was in the same discussion, in the same space. The bloggers, the academics, the journalists, the writers, the news executives, the people running nonprofit organizations, the people running news businesses. And there was almost none of the rancor or tension that characterized the 2005 meeting at Harvard that you were at with me and people like Jill Abramson, who is the managing editor of the New York Times, on one side, and bloggers on the other side.
Do you see this as a continuation of that, this meeting that you were at? Was that the same format?
It wasn't a continuation exactly, but to me it's the same discussion 4 years later.
So there was no rancor, there was no distinction, no difference. Everybody agreed. What?
Right.
What did they agree with? What did they –
just that, that all these – problems are everyone's problems, and that
that's because they don't have me there. You wouldn't have had that unity if I
okay.
Well, I think what they did was they got the guys out of there that didn't agree with them. It's like, doesn't mean the problem went away.
Not exactly, but I mean, I just mean that the starting points of
you and I do not agree on everything, Jay. I don't think we do.
Well, that's fair enough.
Yeah, I don't think we do, and which is fine. You know, there's no problem with that. But I don't think that the box is going to stay the same shape at all. And I don't think that the question of how do you subsidize news is too presumptuous. You know, if you're going to have
I don't think that's the only question. I think that's one question about the news.
Well, but you see, the thing about if you ask that question that way, it presumes that there's no way to get the news without it being subsidized.
No,
and
I don't think it does. But I
see what I think.
Where you're
okay.
Going.
You what?
I don't think it presumes that, but I see where you're going.
Let me just say where I'm going then. The thing is that, let's see, I forgot what I was going to say. That we may have to figure out how to get our news, or it may just start coming to us without it being subsidized. You know, this, when it gets subsidized, doesn't it get the conflict of interest? Don't you suspect?
Well, there's no perfect subsidy system. Yeah, there's definitely another element enters in.
Wouldn't it be ideal if you could get it direct? You know, this is all the sources go direct thing, right? In other words,
yeah.
can I get it without the filter? Can I have a mirror that doesn't amplify or distort or color? You know, I would prefer that, you know. Can we find, when we find, you know, like the system that Scott Rosenberg's putting together to find bugs, can we have one class of bugs being distortion, that it distorted it or it overemphasized one thing and forgot to emphasize something else, so that we can find those conflicts due to subsidy, you know? Because I think we've accepted that way too much, way too long. You know, in a sense, I think Scott may have, like, an insurmountable job, because once he starts, he'll find basically that, like, everything is that way. I don't know.
Well, a couple things on that, Dave. First, one of the interesting things that happened at the conference was that the conference itself, which, of course, like all conferences today, was being tweeted by a lot of the people who were there. It was also live-streamed on the web, was reported out to those who weren't there but were interested in it very successfully without any centralized system at all. It was self-reported. There was no journalist who doing it. There wasn't a raconteur, a reporter necessary to do it. It was like the participants did it themselves. And
nobody subsidized it, right?
Nobody subsidized it, and nobody organized it. And so your point is well taken in that sense. It was an example of a self-informing public, which I think is relevant to the new system.
Isn't that beautiful? I mean,
beautiful about it. Yeah, yeah. There definitely is.
I mean, for that particular group of people, I mean, you know, there you go. They wouldn't think of themselves as a crowd, would they? But they just did behave
they
like one.
They did it. They reported the event themselves without central authority being necessary to organize any of it. Yeah. Because they had the tools to do it.
The other
thing is that, though, that here's where I don't agree with you. And this is like a philosophical point. When we report on events, whether we're eyewitnesses or we're beat reporters or bloggers or sources going direct, in my way of thinking, we have to compose an account of what happened. Whatever kind of report we issue, there's a stage of composition, whether it's writing the tweet or composing your blog post or shooting and editing the film, or even just, as you know, setting up the camera, right? And therefore, it's not correct to say no filters. There's always a selection process. There's always a composition in the literal sense of the term. And I don't think that's a source of error necessarily. I don't think it's a flaw. I think it's part of human communication. You have to compose your account. When you do that, you include some things, you leave some things out. And, of course, the problem of distortion is real, and there is such a thing as bias, and there is such a thing as a filter that leaves too much out, and there's always a problem there. But I don't think it's a very human goal to imagine a new system without that stage of composition. That's where I
know. I do agree with you, okay? I absolutely do, right? And it's, let's say you optimize and optimize and optimize to remove filters wherever you possibly can, you're still going to have a distortion effect. When a human birth, human being tells a story, you're getting it from that point of view. And we all understand that. I think we are totally in agreement on that, right? This goes back to the question that David Weinberger asked at the meeting at the 2004 Democratic Convention, where he asked the AP reporter, who are you going to vote for? And the guy argued with him, I don't need to tell you that. And that was the moment, for me at least, when it was defined, this is the people on one side say this is important that you tell us that, and the group on the other side vehemently says we can't tell you that, right?
Right.
So there's,
but what,
okay,
then
so,
why do you use
so
the
that,
term
so,
error? I don't get it. Why do you use the term mirror?
I use error. You know, mirror. Oh, mirror.
Mirror.
Because, okay, I'll tell you why. Right. Because I want to at least try to get the transparency, right? The problem has been is that reporters, I don't know how to put this. Let me just try. You know, reporters are bullies. in my experience, they throw their weight around. Now, this isn't without exception, okay? This is not without exception, okay? So I don't want to make it like somebody, there aren't any good reporters. There are. But more often than not, the reporter gets to a place and then decides to become a gatekeeper. And that has to stop. That kind of glory, there has to be fear of exposure for that. There has to be fear of losing your job. It's like the ski instructor that makes the skier look bad on purpose, okay? You know, or makes them fall or whatever. It's unethical, right? But it happens all the time. I mean, I know reporters that will not let certain people be in their newspaper. Even if they make news, they can't be in the newspaper. Well, that's ridiculous, okay? That is not, so that's not a question of human being introducing a little bit of, distortion, because human beings always add distortion. That's a deliberate and willful example of a person getting power and deciding to be exclusive. The reporters can't do that.
Okay,
reporters,
well, they shouldn't
have
do that,
a choice.
Of course, yeah.
Right.
But we're not going to get there by telling them to be mirrors. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I'm not telling them to be mirrors. I'm saying this is my ideal,
okay?
My ideal, okay? They don't listen to me anyway, so what the hell? Or if they do, they should take that with a grain of salt. I'm not trying to give them a user's manual. Well, actually, take that back. Try to be a mirror if you can, okay? To the extent that you can. If you catch yourself adding something to something that shouldn't be there, take it out. Mm-hmm. If you find
there are a lot of reporters who have that ethic, yeah.
I do this myself, okay? Like, I keep these lists on Twitter, right? And I said, I have this innovators list, and I said at one point, I have to hold my nose while I put some of these people on the list, Because these are not people I like. They're not people I don't like them. But the fact is, they are innovative. They do new things, and they change the world, Sorry about that. They do new things, and I respect that, okay? They think creatively and whatever. But I don't like them as people,
I think a lot of professional reporters have that ethic that you have, that you're just describing.
Good. Then that's good, and I want to enforce that and make heroes out of those people and, whatever. And when I find the opposite, I want them to stop doing it. I want them to be scared of being discovered. They operate in the open. In the past, in the old unrebooted system, they operate openly as, they don't care.
All right. Well, let's move on.
Okay. Where would you like to move to?
Did you follow at all this week some of the noises coming out of the Murdoch camp about what they're going
vaguely,
to do? Well,
what did they say?
Part of it was really interesting. First of all, everything they say has to be looked at with suspicion, because I don't think that Murdoch and his empire actually know how to tell the truth. I think that they are. It's not that they lie; it's that they don't really care whether there's any correspondence between what they're saying they're going to do and what they're actually doing or going to do.
They're saying it for the manipulative effect.
Completely manipulative. And what's really sad is that the Wall Street Journal, a great newspaper, can't even report on this. It's pathetic, really, with the way that the Wall Street Journal, even owned by Murdoch, cannot see through some of the things that Murdoch is saying because the obvious conflicts of interest. But he said that, first of all, they're delaying their plan to put paywalls around all their sites, but they still are going to go through with that. And then a correspondent from Sky, which is one of his own networks, interviewing Murdoch himself, said, if you think that the search engines are really undermining your business and are really stealing content from you unfairly, the aggregators are a big part of the problem, why don't you just remove your sites from Google? And he says, I think we're going to do that when we start charging. And so everybody starts speculating about, what does that mean, and is that really true, and can they really do that, and what would be the real cost? And then a little bit later, it comes out that this is related to Bing and Microsoft's attempts to kind of move in on Google and search, and Bing seems to be offering newspaper publishers a chance to perhaps make a little money from Bing if they transfer in effect their content over to Bing and sever their relationships with Google in a sense of who indexes whom. So now you have this threat to make a deal with Bing for exclusive rights to index and search newspaper content, which isn't necessarily clear. It's hard to know what the outlines of such a deal would be because it hasn't happened yet. But anyway, that was the idea. So my reaction was like, I'm so tired of listening to these news companies from Murdoch to the AP to the rest moan and gripe about Google that I want them to like go ahead and try. If you really feel completely aggrieved by this system, then do it. Pull out of Google, put robots.txt file, code on your sites, make them unsearchable by Google, take whatever cash Bing might be offering you, and let's just see what happens. Because it's better than listening to these whines. Anyway, that was my reaction. Yours?
About that, yeah. I mean,
go ahead and do it already.
I don't really care. I mean, I don't know. Do I read any Fox, Murdoch? Do I read any Murdoch news? I mean,
Wall Street Journal, London Times, Wall Street New York Post.
Wall
Street Journal is already behind the paywall. Yeah.
I don't care. I mean, I think it's more interesting that they replaced Lou Dobbs with John King at CNN, but that's not even that important. I'm in a hotel room here today, and last night when I had a little bit of time to kill, I put on CNN, and I watched a little bit of Al Gore, and it hurt me so much just to watch the pain that Larry King was putting Al Gore through, you know, that he would ask him a question, and Al Gore, you know, it would either be a question that Al Gore has a prepared answer for, in which case that's what we get, or it's one that Al Gore would never answer in a million years, and so we get him saying, basically, I would never answer that in a million years. You know, he doesn't use those words, but he, you know, he asks him, do you think Barack Obama's been doing a great job, you know, so far? Well, what the fuck is he going to say? It's like, is he going to say, we don't need to go any further. So I turned
it
off.
Here's my take on CNN. Every time, and you can check this out yourself, every time there's a development about CNN and its place in the news system, the reporters who cover the television industry portray CNN as in this difficult spot where opinion seems to work on cable news, and they point to Fox and MSNBC, and CNN has to decide whether it should remain with straight news, right? And this is the way they frame the choices. And, of course, this is a perfect example of what you were saying earlier. They frame the choice that way because they actually believe in straight news as superiority. And
yeah. Oh,
because that's how they see
but
what they're doing.
But Don King is
right.
So sterile. There's nothing there.
Right.
It's an empty cell of a person. There's absolutely
right.
Nothing inside this person. You know, I mean...
there's an
Lou
example.
Dobbs,
they don't frame
Dobbs,
it as sterility versus voice.
There, yeah?
Right. They don't frame it as sterility versus voice because that's just not natural to them. What's natural
I don't
is
care. You know what?
Opinion.
Who cares? Yeah, well, you know what? I flipped this, I turned it off, and I don't know what. You know, staring out the window and looking at the courtyard is more interesting than watching that mess, you know, that they call news. There's nothing interesting about it. Now, I wish they'd bring back Aaron Brown. You know, I mean, that was the moment which they could. I mean, I liked Aaron Brown.
Aaron Brown, too, yeah.
He would find the interesting side of things and, you know, sort of twist things around. I don't know why they didn't like him, but, you know.
Yeah,
they,
I liked
him,
too. He actually had me on twice on CNN.
See, there you go. That's exactly. How did I know that? I mean, I didn't. Of course, he would have you on because you're an interesting guest, right? You know. Obviously.
Here's the
third
opportunity.
But Anderson Cooper is another one of these people who, if he had a personality, it's been removed long ago, and there's nothing there. I mean, so sorry. Yeah, whatever. So
here's the third choice that gets eclipsed, though, Dave. This is what I wanted to add. It's not opinion versus straight news, there's a third option, which is to learn from John Stewart that if you can't call bullshit on people when they bullshit you on air, you're not really a news network. And if CNN took its charter to be like the leading news network and just learned a little bit from Stewart and his show about how to call bullshit on bullshit, that would start to be an identity that they could build into a franchise. But they won't do that.
And that would change with a lot of people that wouldn't come on anymore. And, you know, and also stop putting people on who have absolutely nothing to say and no experience.
Yeah, you couldn't have your Republican strategist on anymore.
Right.
He's just giving you, you know. But what kind
because
of a loss would that
be?
No loss at all.
Bullshit. Or just have a little sign that comes under his name, a little light, a bullshit light.
Learn from Stewart.
I have a couple of things I want to talk about. We got like 5 minutes, 4 minutes.
Yes.
Okay, a couple little housekeeping. No, actually, one of them is not housekeeping. The droid today, we still have to talk about the droid. There's a lot of cool stuff on it. The thing I discovered today was you can do voice search, and their voice search is uncannily, amazingly good. I mean, you can say Jay Rosen.
What does voice search mean? I don't even understand what that
is. Well, okay, what it means is I say to my phone, Jay Rosen, and it takes about a second, and then comes up the search results for Jay Rosen.
Searching what?
It's just like as if I type Jay Rosen into the search box on Google.
Oh, so it searches the web based on voice commands? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievably good. If you try, say, you know, it was so good that it was 15 minutes worth of playing with it before I decided to say a four-letter word, and it just buzzes at you when you do that. And you know that they put that in there because they're so good that you know they knew what you said. You know.
Yeah, they know that sophomore fools like you are going to do it.
Oh, come on. I'm like everybody. Come on, everybody does that. And the only one thing was I said the name of a guy I went to, was in fifth and sixth grade with. And they got his name wrong. They said it was Fart James. But that was even better. Anyway, that was the lighthearted. Now the business side of things. We got a new blog. It's rebootnews.com, right?
Right.
And something interesting happened when we made the switch. We're starting to get some comments. Starting to get really interesting over there. And so that's one thing I want to say is that if you're listening, if you made it all the way this far,
comment on the show.
Yeah, you owe it to yourself to come to the blog and, you know, say what you thought about the show. I would really love to hear from you. I think Jay, you would probably love to hear from me too.
Sure,
right?
Give us a piece of your mind. Just make sure it's not the last piece.
Now the thing I want to ask you, Jay, is this: is sometimes there was one comment in particular from Matt Terenzio. In the last bit of about 32, the last show, the Jennifer Preston show, that I thought was good enough to be a blog post. But I didn't put it out there because I actually put one blog post up myself that was an essay. So, you know, and I sort of took a chance there. I wanted to ask you how you feel about that and how do you feel about rebooting the news becoming like a community site for people. Somebody posts something there that looks good enough to be a blog post. How do you feel about it becoming a blog post?
I'd be fine with that as long as it's tied to a specific show.
Yeah, okay. Really?
And the context of its reply to the show is made clear. If we can connect it to a episode, then it makes sense.
Why don't we start there? Because I'm gonna push you. I'd like to see it go a little bit further than that. Like if Jeff Jarvis had something he wanted to say and he felt that it belonged under the umbrella of rebooting the news, that I think I would like be inclined to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'd like to leave the door open, but we don't have to do that right now. And of course, what I will do is I'll check with you on any individual one. You know, shoot you a pointer and ask you what you think about it. If I see anything like that, this is by way of an invitation to people to write comments on the blog that may represent opinions that are, you know, that you've developed yourself that aren't just like, you know, he's full of it or he's full of it or, you know, he's just preening or whatever. There have been some of those kind of comments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I let them through. What the hell, you know? But anyway, that would be
all right. Well, that's cool. I'm just trying as much as I can these days to enforce a connection between text and context, between update and background. And I really want those two things to come at us together. That's like one of my themes. But I'm certainly open to making it a more of a community site, sure.
Okay, we'll take one step at a time then. We're out of time now, so thanks for another great show, Jay.
All right, Dave. Been a pleasure. Bye for now.
Okay. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.